Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it has presented a Gaza ceasefire proposal to mediators with the aim of putting an end to ongoing campaign of genocide. Yemen's Ansarullah leader says operations against Israeli-linked vessels will extend to include ships crossing the Indian Ocean. And Russians are heading to polls throughout the country in a three-day presidential election. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it's put forth a new proposal for a Gaza ceasefire with the aim of ending Israeli war on the besieged territory. Hamas says it has presented the proposal to Egyptian and Qatari mediators. The movement says under this proposal, the occupying Israeli forces have to leave Gaza. Hamas says this proposal also includes return of displaced Palestinians to their homes and providing them with aid. Exchange of Palestinian prisoners with Israeli captives held in Gaza is also included. Reports say the initial exchange will see release of Israeli women, children, the elderly, and sick. They'll be freed in return for the release of 700 to 1,000 Palestinians. The Israeli regime, though, said the new Hamas position is based on what it called unrealistic demands. Senior Hamas official Osama Hamdan has already said any Israeli opposition only means that the regime wants to continue this war. Meanwhile, the Israeli military has conducted new attacks on different locations throughout Gaza. Our correspondent in the central city of Deir al-Balah earlier joined us with some details.
In the meantime, the Israeli occupation artillery maintained its shelling towards the eastern part of several areas of Gaza Strip, particularly here in Deir al-Balah city and Al-Mughraga neighborhood and even Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. Heavy artillery shelling reached those areas, and that shelling actually was maintained over the night. And even in Jabalia refugee camp and in Khan Yunis city, the Israeli artillery also maintained and continued their attacks and airstrikes. In the meantime, the central areas of Khan Yunis city and Jabalia refugee camp also were hit relentlessly by those Israeli continuous airstrikes. Several residential buildings destroyed over those cruel attacks.
And condemnations continue pouring in over Israel's massacre of over 100 Palestinians waiting for humanitarian aid in Gaza City on Thursday. The Palestinian Mujahideen movement says Israel's shelling of aid seekers at the Kuwaiti roundabout is a stain of shame for anyone complicit in the crime. The resistance movement held the U.S. and other Western states, along with some Arab countries, responsible for Israel's genocide in Gaza. Another resistance movement, Hamas, reacted as well, criticizing failure of the international community and the UN to take action against Israel. Hamas said inaction has given the regime the green light to commit such horrific crimes against Palestinians. Israel has time and again targeted aid seekers in Gaza in the past several weeks. The regime unleashed its war back in early October, killing over 31,300 people, most of them women and children. And now, leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says the country will expand its military operations against Israeli-linked ships and will prevent their crossing through the Indian Ocean.
Our main battle is to prevent ships associated with the Israeli army not only from passing through the Arabian Sea, the Red Sea, and the Gulf of Aden, but also with the grace and assistance of Allah Almighty. We aim to prevent their crossing through the Indian Ocean and from South Africa towards the Cape of Good Hope. This is an important, advanced, and significant step, and we have already begun to carry out operations related to it.
Ansarullah leader said so far three operations have been conducted in the Indian Ocean. The Yemeni armed forces have been attacking Israeli-linked ships in the Red Sea since mid-November to force the regime into stopping its campaign of genocide in Gaza. And in response, the U.S. and U.K. have launched a series of airstrikes on Yemen for what they call protecting international shipping. Yemen, though, rejects that claim and has retaliated by targeting American and British vessels in the Red Sea. Latest U.S.-led airstrikes hit Yemen's Hajja governorate early Friday. Yemen says Israel, the U.S., and Britain are all responsible for the mounting tensions. And as we follow the ongoing weekly demonstrations in support of Gazans and in condemnation of Israel's campaign of genocide in Yemen, we're also joined at one of the rallies, today's rally, I guess, by Abdul Latif Al-Washali. Hello, Abdul Latif. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in Sana'a. What can you tell us?
Thank you so much. You know, despite the sunny and hot weather, the people here, and also despite their being fasting today, you know, it's Ramadan, but the people have chosen to gather here. You know, they came from across the city to gather in the capital, Sana'a, and also in other cities to express their solidarity with the Palestinian people. They said they can't just remain passive while witnessing the oppressed people of Palestine suffer from killings and being starved to death by at the hands of the Israeli regime. They have to do something. They have to demonstrate. They have to keep provoking the Yemeni army to escalate its operations in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. And today we've seen them being happy after hearing the speech of Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi yesterday, saying that the naval operations now will be escalated and now they will target the Israeli ships, not only in the Red Sea and Bab al-Mandab Strait, but also in the Indian Ocean and in the South Africa. The people today are very happy. They said they will keep telling the Yemeni army and urging the Yemeni army to keep escalating its operations. We will have in a few minutes, I believe, a new statement released by the spokesperson of the Yemeni army, the Brigadier Yahya Sari'. We believe it's going to be about an operation that was conducted last night. We will wait, inshallah, and see what he's going to tell us today.
Okay, so Abdul Latif, Yemenis, these anti-Israeli operations, and I believe Abdul Malik al-Houthi said there were 73 so far, which is a pretty significant anti-Israeli operations in the Red and Arabian Sea, and three so far in the Indian Ocean. So now we're talking about quite a significant geographical area that's going to be covered by Yemen's armed forces targeting these Israeli-linked vessels, three separate seas.
You know, when we heard Sayyid Abdul Malik saying that, we knew that when he said that they have new surprises for the American, the Israelis, and also for the British, they have surprises for them in the sea. We know that it was right. They have, I believe, new weapons, new missiles. They have tested these missiles, and they were successful. They will now be targeting the Israeli ships with those missiles. You know, I remember in 2018, I believe, we heard the General Yahya Sari'a saying that they have been able to manufacture a drone on a daily basis. That was in 2018. I believe now, 6 years later, they have been able to expand the manufacturing of the drones, and they have thousands of drones that they will use them now in targeting the Israeli-linked vessels, not only in the Red Sea and the Bab al-Mandab Strait, but also in the Indian Ocean and in the South Africa. They will now keep hunting the Israeli-linked vessels until the Israeli war and genocidal war against the people in Gaza ceases. It is a right for the Yemeni people to defend our land and also to defend the people in Gaza according to international law.
All right, thank you, Abdul Latif. We'll be following this very closely. We'll probably swing back into you as soon as the Yemeni armed forces make this very highly and much anticipated statement during this rally later. We'll come back live to you, but hang out. We'll talk to you soon. Abdul Latif Al-Washali there joining us from Sana'a.
Thank you.
You bet. Meanwhile, people throughout Russia are heading to polls to choose a new president for the next 6 years. Vote is taking place throughout the country's 11 time zones. More than 112 million people are eligible to cast their ballots from Friday today and through Sunday. Incumbent President Vladimir Putin is running for a fifth term. He has three rivals. They are from the New People Party, the Liberal Democratic Party, and the Communist Party. Now, prior to this election, Putin called on Russians to vote, saying people are the only source of power in his country. He said Russia is going through a difficult period and needs to stay united and confident to overcome it. A vote is also taking place in four regions that Russia annexed from Ukraine back in 2022, namely Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. Conflict in Ukraine has led to a major restructuring of the global weapons market, according to a new report from a top NGO dedicated to peace. Europe has doubled its arms imports in recent years, with Russia dropping from its longtime number two spot behind the U.S. Rami Mazahari reports out of Paris.
The top annual analysis of global arms sales found that France has risen to the number two weapons exporter in the world. The gains have often been made thanks to debt from Ukraine, which has become Europe's largest arms importer. French arms sales have soared 50% in recent years and now comprise 11% of the global market. The world's leading arms dealer is still the United States, which controls a record 42% of the global weapons trade.
For us, it's a little paradoxical that a nation which claims to be a country which greatly respects human rights is also a nation which is so very proud of its weapon sales. It's clear that the values of the French people and human rights are subservient to geostrategic interest, and we shouldn't celebrate France's arming of often dictatorial regimes.
Arms sales to Ukraine has proven to be big business, and it may explain President Emmanuel Macron's about-face on the conflict. 2 years ago, Macron warned that Russia must not be humiliated, but he's recently become one of Europe's leading anti-Russia war hawks. France's top three arms clients are India, which is the world's largest arms importer, followed by Saudi Arabia and tiny but rich Qatar. Africa is still reeling from 40 tons of illegal free arms drops France made in 2011 to support anti-Gaddafi rebels in Libya. As predicted, the weapons soon found their way to Syria, the Central African Republic, Ukraine, and elsewhere.
D'exposer son matériel de guerre.
French arms in Africa allows France to show off their latest weapons and present them as combat proven. So Africa is not just a show window for French arms, but also a testing laboratory, and with always destabilizing results for the continent.
This week, French Parliament approved a 10-year military pact with Kiev, which guarantees billions in more weapons deliveries.
Russia continues to gain ground against NATO-backed Ukraine, which is an important reminder that some weapons are made to work under actual wartime conditions, and some are made mainly for sales and profit. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Nigerian Muslims, like millions of others worldwide, are fasting throughout the holy month of Ramadan. However, rising costs of living in the country cause significant challenges for many during this fasting period. Danjuma Abdullahi reports.
Ramadan, a sacred month in Islam, is a month to cultivate self-discipline, self-control, sacrifice and empathy for those in need. Breaking of the fast in the evening, known as iftar, also fosters a sense of community and sharing as people come together to share a meal. Here in Nigeria, many Muslims are observing the month of Ramadan with fasting while grappling with the economic hardships plaguing the country. The Naira, Nigeria's currency, experienced a historic decline against the dollar in February this year, leading to a rampant inflation that has rendered life exceedingly difficult for many Nigerians. Many people experience hunger before bedtime, making fasting during Ramadan a formidable challenge. Experts assert that there exists a fundamental issue that requires urgent attention. Religious organizations like the Al-Habibiyya Islamic Society have established the food bank, where Muslims donate both money and food to support the less fortunate during Ramadan. Dedicated volunteers cook and package meals, ensuring that hundreds of impoverished fasting Muslims receive a warm meal for iftar in the evening. The Nigerian government has recognized the food challenge and has moved to address it. This is in addition to other critical measures. Beyond palliatives, experts say the Nigerian government must have the right mix of fiscal and monetary policies in order to get out of the economic situation. They say more than 60,000 hectares of farmland have been abandoned in northern Nigeria because of the banditry and kidnapping. The government needs to address the general insecurity in Nigeria. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
And that's a wrap for your news bulletin, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. And goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The dawns of the month of Ramadan should not be missed. The annual Ramadan Quranic meeting, April 30th, 2019. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I sincerely thank the dear brothers, and I've really benefited from your recitation today. It is a very good, beautiful, and meaningful meeting with diverse and mellifluous recitations, and I thank God for this. When we see that each year the signs of progress in reciting the Holy Quran are visible among our youth and our people, this makes me very happy, and I thank God for this. Thanks to these good recitations, today's meeting was very meaningful, significant, and delightful, particularly because of the good point that our talented and eloquent presenter raised regarding the offering of these recitations and what was achieved in this meeting to the pure souls of the martyrs who were buried in Tehran recently. Reciting the Holy Quran in a good voice and tone and by observing the requirements and conventions of recitation is an introduction to the entrance of Quranic concept into hearts. However, if we merely benefit from this aspect of the Holy Quran, and if we only look at it as an act of recitation and beautiful singing, we will surely be demoted from this lofty rank and position.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The purpose of all this emphasis on reciting the Holy Quran in a good voice, in a beautiful tone, and by observing the requirements is that Quranic concepts influence hearts, that we establish a close relationship with the Holy Quran, and that we take a Quranic mold and color. If this is the goal, then it has certain requirements and conventions. The first convention is that the reciter of the Holy Quran should recite the book by believing in the Holy Quran and the concepts that he is reciting. If we do not know what we are reading, if we do not understand the concepts, and if it does not influence us in a deep way, then our recitation will exert little influence on others and on us. This is the first condition. I request that the Honorable Qura, Quranic experts and reciters of the Holy Quran, pay attention to this point. First, they should review in their minds the ayahs that they want to recite. They should deliberate on them and truly absorb the depth of these concepts in their hearts and their belief.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave
face to face.
I'm Marzia Hashimi, and very happy to bring you a very special Hidden Files today, dealing with the situation in Palestine and talking to someone who understands and knows the Zionist regime very well. I'm very happy to welcome to the program Sheikh Talal Abdurrahman Shirim, a former prisoner in Israeli regime prisons, and he's also currently the head of the prisoners' files for Hamas. Thank you so much, Sheikh, for being with us here on Hidden Files. Now, as a former prisoner who spent 18 years in Israeli jails, how much do you value your freedom today, and how hopeful are you about the liberation of the occupied Palestinian territories?
I seek refuge in Allah from the curse of Satan. May peace and blessings of Allah be upon the most honorable creation and the master of Prophet Muhammad and upon all his family. First of all, thank you for having me today to clarify issues regarding the prisoner's file. Currently, I'm in charge of this file. No one can speak about a prison better than the one who was jailed in it. According to poetry, no one knows the difficulty of something except those who are grappling with it. Freedom is priceless and a must. If I want to maintain my dignity, I have to preserve this homeland. Hence, what we pursue, which is the liberation of Palestine, is precious, and the price that we pay is high. The Palestinian detainee suffers two pains. The first pain, when his house is raided by the occupation's army. The troops detonate the doors using bombs, and then enter the home and begin ransacking it, destroying everything inside. They terrify the children, women and fathers and mothers, in plain sight of the prisoner, who is handcuffed behind his back. Any person in that house who wants to protest or speak is hit in plain sight of the entire family. This is the first suffering that the detainee grapples with. The army ransacks the house and takes everything inside. If the troops find money, they steal it. They also steal the jewelry of the women, and they take any electronic devices, such as computers and phones. They confiscate everything. And if the prisoner has a car, they also seize it under the pretext that it was used in supporting terrorism. That prisoner is taken in plain sight of the children who scream. This also constitutes a suffering for the family, for the children, for the women, for the father and for the mother. Afterwards, the second suffering that the prisoner will endure begins when he is placed in the army troops' vehicle and taken for interrogation. On the way to the interrogation, the detainee is physically and verbally assaulted and hears blasphemous words. All of that is part of a psychological torture that precedes the interrogation. We will talk about the interrogation later in the interview, but I want to say that the interrogation is inhuman. Allah the Almighty said in the Quran, "Indeed, we have dignified the children of Adam." So it doesn't make sense that another child of Adam comes and breach your freedom and attack you and your ideas and religion and doctrine. That's kind of insane, but as I have said, Palestine is precious. Palestine is the heart of the Arab and Muslim world, and whatever sacrifices we make, they will remain slight compared to the goal of liberating Palestine.
Well, according to human rights groups, more than 8,000 Palestinians are currently lodged in Israeli jails. Can you share more specific details about the total number of detainees, including those arrested since October the 7th?
Unfortunately, there is false information even among the human rights groups, the Red Cross, etc. But as a person who is in charge of that file, I will give you the accurate figures. Before October 7th, some 5,200 detainees were imprisoned, including about 450 children and minors under the age of 18 and 35 women. The rest of the detainees were men. But after October 7th, the occupation authorities launched a crazy, brutal campaign against Palestinians, arresting members of the Legislative Council, engineers, doctors, university students, general public, former prisoners, women and children. Now, the number of Palestinians held in Israeli jails exceeds 12,000. That means 7,000 more Palestinians have been detained since October 7th. That's kind of insane because about 7,000 people were detained during just 4 months. Between 7,000 and 8,000 people are also reported missing, and their whereabouts are unknown. So we're talking about a huge number of detainees and prisoners. These were the actual figures of Palestinian detainees held in Israeli jails.
We often come across horrifying stories of systematic torture inside Israeli jails. Inmates electrocuted, deprived of food and sleep, denied medical care, handcuffed and assaulted, and even sexual abuse. Does the apartheid regime use torture as a weapon of war against Palestinians?
I have been detained 10 times since the first Intifada or uprising in 1987. I was detained and released 10 times. So I have a lot of experience and have a lot to say about what takes place during the interrogations and about the horrifying stories I heard from my fellow detainees. Regarding torture, I have said that the torture starts from the moment of arrest and continues until the end of the interrogation. During the interrogation, all inhuman techniques are used, such as stripping the detainees of his clothes, with the interrogator mocking him or flirting with him as a kind of assault. But honestly, no sexual assault takes place, and I haven't heard something about that. The individual, however, could be threatened with sexual assault. The wives or sisters of some of the detainees were also detained and brought to the interrogation. There, the men were threatened with subjecting their wives or sisters to sexual abuse if they refused to make a confession. This is a method to force the detainees to speak and make a confession. Some of the detainees break down and speak up as they want their wives, sisters, or mothers to return home, and subsequently the interrogator gets what he wants. Sometimes it is the detainees who threaten the interrogators that if their wives or sisters were not freed, they would witness unprecedented things. These strong men instilled fear in the regime's authorities that later released those women who were used as tools to exert pressure on their husbands or brothers who were being interrogated. Regarding the other techniques, I personally spent a week, 7 days, sitting on a chair with my hands cuffed behind my back and my face covered. I spent 7 days without sleep and without food during the fasting month of Ramadan. They were giving us just one meal every 2 or 3 days. When I was asking for water, they were spilling water on the floor. So if you wanted to drink water, you had to drink the water spilled on the floor. These were among the interrogation techniques. There were other techniques that depended on the case or the method adopted by the interrogator. There was the good guy, bad guy technique, where one interrogator speaks nicely, kindly asking the detainee whether he has a wife and children, and speaks about releasing him and giving him money in order to encourage him to speak up. In return, there was an aggressive interrogator who was beating, insulting, and spitting on the detainee, and doing everything you can imagine. What's currently happening in Israeli jails is harsher than what happened in the U.S. detention centers of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay. I can say that they all learned from the same source how to torture and humiliate the people. There are many methods of torture in jails that require several interviews in order to address them, as each person and each charge has a certain method. Sometimes interrogations result in deaths. In Israeli jails, more than 5 were killed due to torture. They were suffocated while being handcuffed. They put a piece of cloth on the mouth of the detainee. The detainee could be suffering from a disease and the interrogator doesn't know that, and subsequently, such techniques could result in his death. Some people died during the interrogations. When I was in the Tolkien Central Prison, one of the detainees who was sitting next to me during the interrogation was martyred. He died due to torture. Then, there are many methods of torture. Sometimes they even resort to Israel's Supreme Court to obtain a license to torture ruling because the interrogator doesn't want to bear the responsibility of that severe torture and wants the court to be responsible instead if that detainee dies. So they obtain a decision from the court and sit the detainee down and shake him for a long period of time, and that subsequently inflicts a brain injury on him that leaves him either dead or mentally ill. Some people die because of that method of heinous torture. What people watch on TV is nothing compared to what actually happens. You saw how they stripped scores, hundreds and thousands of people of their clothes in front of cameras amid freezing temperatures, let alone what happens behind closed doors. They strip people of their clothes and put them on a wet floor and turn on air conditioners, switching back and forth from cooling to heating. During 1 to 2 days, those detainees fall ill due to that method of torture. All these methods were aimed at pressing the detainee to forcibly admit to something. There are methods that are less heinous, but still heinous, such as imprisoning the individual in a certain room with people portrayed as honorable Palestinian detainees and fighters, but in fact, they are spies who work for the Israeli regime and deceive the detainee to obtain information from him. There are other soft techniques, such as providing the detainee with the most delicious food. While the detainee is hungry, the interrogator brings delicious food and begins eating and asks the detainee if he wants to share him the food, saying, "How are you? Here you are." If the detainee ate, he will also be offered coffee, tea, cigarettes, etc. That's another method to obtain confession from the weak people. But the real fighters refuse to eat or drink anything. No matter how much I spoke about methods of torture, they still exceed the imagination. And what we currently see is just part of the suffering that Palestinian detainees are grappling with in Israeli jails. That was concerning the interrogation phase. In the next stage, and after a forced confession is written, the detainee could be sent from cells to another place that we call the big prison. There, he sees his fellow detainees and begins a new life compatible with the prison's laws, which are set by the regime's authorities, who place each 4 or 5 people in a 2x2 or 2x3 meter room. There are also larger rooms, such as 10x5 meter rooms, in which 30 to 40 prisoners are placed. Then the prisoners are diverse. That was what I had to say in brief about the issue of the torture of detainees.
I mean, it's so unbelievable and so heartbreaking hearing what the prisoners go through because of the Zionist regime. And recently, a statement by the Palestinian Prisoners Club said detainees are being denied medical care, not transferred to clinics or hospitals in case of medical emergency. Is it because of their protests against the inhumane prison conditions?
While we are in a state of war, all the laws have changed. Despite its ugliness, the occupation ultimately adheres to the law of the International Committee of the Red Cross or some international and human rights bodies in order to appear democratic and civilized. But all the masks have fallen amid the ongoing war. There's no democracy, there are no human rights, no humanity in the Israeli regime's dealings. So we see it innovating new torture techniques for the sake of deterrence. The regime used to insult to obtain forced confession. But now, and amid the war, the regime aims at pressing the resistance. The regime uses the scenes of the arrest of women and children in order to press the resistance to submit to its demands. Then they want to obtain what they failed to obtain through weapons and explosives and through murders and physical assaults by pressuring the fighters when they witness the mistreatment of their women, children, and people. That is a means of pressure and a dirty war. Any war has its own means, such as a means of destruction, such as bombs and weapons of mass destruction. But the other means is to torture the civilians who are not involved in any operations in order to press the fighters to give up and raise the white flag. The more dirty method is that occupation deprives people from food and water. In northern Gaza, we have famine in every sense of the word. There is no edible thing there. There are more than 60,000 pregnant women who have nothing to eat. How will their fetuses be nourished? Dozens of fetuses die in their mothers' wombs, and those who are born alive find no milk or drink. The babies have nothing to eat and subsequently die. There are cases of child deaths due to malnourishment. In prisons, we knew the meaning of hunger because we went on hunger strikes to restore our rights that the prison's authorities deprived us from, or to protest against punitive measures adopted against us. Sometimes, we didn't eat anything for a month or 2 months, so we felt pains, including in the head and the knee, and grappled with weakness. After 2 to 3 weeks, the hunger striker becomes unable to stand up and walk, and instead remains in bed. Thus, hunger leaves people collapsed. The case now is not concerning a number of hunger strikers in prisons, but concerning an entire nation that is suffering. More than 700,000 people in Gaza have no food. Israel also destroys medical facilities such as hospitals and medicines. There are no medicines in Gaza. There are 10,000 cancer patients in Gaza, and they have no medication and are dying slowly. Regarding the normal cases, we have over 350,000 patients who don't even have access to a Panadol tablet for the headache, let alone those whose legs or hands have been amputated. How will they be treated? Many of them see their bodies decompose. And when a decomposed part of their body is amputated, another part begins to decompose. So they cut the other part off after a week or so on. Someone told me that he buried his father in three phases as his father's hand and leg were cut off during a strike on their house. So the son took them and buried them under the ground. Later, that same family was targeted in another strike that amputated his father's second leg. So the son took it and buried it in another cemetery. The father later died due to those injuries. So the son buried him for the third time. Can you imagine that a person can be buried in three phases? Where does that happen? All of that take place amid the world's silence. I mean, the entire world, including human rights organizations and the United Nations, all their meetings are fruitless. That's because Israel is the spoiled son of the United States. Israel is the U.S.'s dirty tool in the region. So we fight for the sake of our dignity and in order to restore our land. No matter the price that we pay, that will remain little compared to the restoration of our dignity and the preservation of our land and sanctities. God willing, we will move forward on the path until the end.
Well, earlier this month, a human rights group cited shocking testimonies from recently freed detainees, including the Israeli military, inviting settlers to watch the gory torture of Palestinians. On the other hand, we saw how Israeli captives spoke highly of their captors. I mean, what does this say about the two sides?
I spoke about part of those scenes, but there is another tragedy. These are settlers. Settlers have violated the remaining part of the Palestinian land, going beyond the part granted by the world. The world gave Israel a state and gave Palestine a state, but it was not established. Day by day, settlers steal the land. The disaster is that the settlers burn and rob the houses and attack the Palestinians and do whatever they want while the Israeli army does not move a muscle. The army sees everything. What hurts more is that the army brings those settlers to the prisons to see how Palestinian detainees are humiliated, or subsequently they boost the morale of their people and settlers through showing them the pains of the Palestinians who are held in the prisons. That's humanly unacceptable, and those people breached all the limits of humanity, and we shouldn't even call them human beings.
Some reports have pointed to an alarming spike in so-called administrative detention since October 7th, mostly minors who were held without charges or without trial. How would you describe this travesty of justice?
The detention process is divided into several sections. I spoke about the first section, which is the interrogation and investigation into cases and operations carried out by Palestinian fighters who strive to restore their land. But there is another kind of detentions in which no interrogations take place, and subsequently the detainees are not subjected to related torture. However, they experience another kind of suffering as the detainee is imprisoned without charge or interrogation. Administrative detention is originally British. When Britain was ruling Palestine, it created administrative detentions. Later, the Israeli regime inherited that policy from the British. Under that policy, the detainee is imprisoned without a charge for 6 months that could be extended for another 6 months and later for another year and so on. Some people were jailed for 18 to 20 years under the administrative detention policy just because the regime's authorities suspected them without evidence or proof. That's the height of crime. No other part of the world uses that policy. In fact, Palestine is the sole occupied country in the world. All the countries have been liberated, except Palestine. In Palestine, all inhumane laws are practiced. Many people were jailed under the administrative detentions, and that policy was not used against just 5, 10, 20, or 100 people. Before the Al-Aqsa flood operation, there were over 1,000 administrative detainees. But after Israel launched a brutal arrest campaign, the number of administrative detainees exceeded 3,000. They include doctors, engineers, ordinary people, and university students. Even minors are jailed under the administrative detention policy. I also want to mention one of the ugliest practices that I just remembered, which is the unexplained death of people in prison. Since October 7th, 11 people, including administrative detainees, died under torture. They were killed during just 4 months. Isn't that kind of insane? In return, you saw how Palestinians in Gaza treated the Israeli captives. They treated them humanely and shared their food with them, according to the Israeli captives' testimonies. We saw a released woman carrying her dog, while people in Gaza have no food. Her dog was in a good condition. So the way Israeli captives are treated differ from the way Palestinians held in Israeli jails are treated. In Palestine, the Israeli captives are treated humanely, despite the war and destruction. In the Israeli regime, which claims to be a democracy, you see the height of ignobility.
At the same time, there are also heartening stories about detainees engaging in creative activities inside jails. For example, Bassem Khandanjik recently released his book, A Mask in the Color of Sky, written inside of a jail and nominated for an international prize. Where does this never say die spirit come from?
Sometimes the individual who loves the life never submits to pressure and always looks for ways to develop himself and convey his message to the world, even from the prison. The big prison to which the detainee is sent after being interrogated is a school where the detainee learns from the professors who are also imprisoned. Imprisonment is an ordeal, but we turn it into a granting. Some people were illiterate when they entered prison, but they left it with college degrees. Some people memorize the Holy Quran in prison. We turn prisons into schools and universities. We reached agreements with universities in Gaza and Lebanon and contacted them through professors who are held in these prisons. That has helped educate the Palestinians. Palestinians are by nature intellectual and love knowledge and dissemination of science. So we saw them writing books. The book that you mentioned was nominated for an international award, so its author gained fame. But there are hundreds of other people who authored books while in prison, and their books are released and just need to be interpreted into English and other languages. So we turn the ordeal into a blessing through investing in knowledge and education inside these prisons. There were 11 brothers who got a PhD degree while they were in prison. Each year, about 150 people get a master's degree, either from Gaza University, Palestine University, Jinan University in Lebanon, or other universities. So the education process is ongoing in prisons, despite the attempts of the prison authorities to prevent detainees from learning. These attempts include tearing up papers and breaking pens. We even went on hunger strikes for more than 45 days in order to obtain a book, pen, or a notebook. So we were grabbing our right to education. At some point, we even forced the regime to give us access to some specializations in Hebrew universities. They only gave some of them that access with the aim of changing their ideas. Some experts in Hebrew affairs learned Hebrew inside prison and studied in Israeli universities. The Palestinians are heroes and generous. The Palestinian nation pursues freedom and knowledge. Like other nations, we want to preserve our dignity and freedom. We are the sole country in the world that's still occupied.
Thank you very much for being with us, Sheikh Talal Abdurrahman Sharim, a former prisoner of the Israeli regime and the head of the prisoners' files for Hamas. I appreciate you being with us. I'm Marzia Hashemi, and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program, The Last Savior. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in this studio, we have a special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Oman, Islamic researcher, Brother Alavi. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's a pleasure to be here.
So in this series of the program, The Last Savior, we are mainly concerned with the topics related to Imam al-As, Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance. So during both minor occultation and major occultation of Imam al-As, there have been some people who claimed to visit Imam al-Zaman or Imam al-As. There have been some signs, some, we can say, characteristics mentioned by Imam al-As himself for such a situation that, for example, if such and such person claims to visit me, he is a liar, or at least he claims falsely. But how to distinguish between the right and wrong visitors of Imam al-As? Is it possible at all or not? This is the first question. And if we face such a person who claims to visit Imam al-As, what should we do?
These visitations and tasharrufat towards Imam alayhi salam are definitely right and true, and they have been documented in the course of history in the last 14 centuries. Whether to the Imams who were alive and companions were going to them, and even to the Imam Mahdi alayhi salam in the time of his minor and major occultation. I mean, there is no doubt in this. And we have referred to different kinds of visitations of Imam alayhi salam, either to be in person or through a heart contact. Definitely there is no doubt in these issues. Through heart relation, it is known as a relation with Imam and visitation of Imam alayhi salam, because some meanings are transferred here in these even heart contacts.
Yes.
But what is important, due to some circumstances, the visitations of Imam alayhi salam at the time of his minor occultation were disclosed and were told to the people, and there were some people who were known as the deputies and nawab of Imam. They officially said,
special deputies or representatives of the Imam. Safir, they called it. Yes.
Definitely.
Yes.
They were saying to the people that this is a message that I'm just receiving from Imam alayhi salam. There was no doubt on that. And they have been introduced to the people, to the Shia communities and the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt.
And the interesting point that Imam asked himself, because they confirmed them and approved them and named them, that one by one such people will come and will be my representative, four of them, okay?
Exactly. But with regard to those hadith and narrations that says anyone who claims that had a relation or, I don't know, visitation of Imam alayhi salam, he is known as kadhab or liar. This is true that we have some series of hadith that says that even up to the time of emergence of or appearance of Sufyani, that this is before the reappearance of Imam alayhi salam, anyone who claims that he had a relation with Imam or had any form of visitation of Imam alayhi salam, he is a liar. True. But when we are talking about these issues, it doesn't mean that those who had already visited Imam, they are liars. Because they never ever came to claim in person that, okay, I had visited Imam Ali Salam in that time and Imam told me such a thing and such and such have been discussed in my visitation of Imam Ali Salam.
Or, for example, Imam gave me the authority to do this and that.
Finding this tawfiq, this blessing to be able to just visit Imam. But definitely there are some duties for those who have this chance that they are visiting Imam Ali Salam. They are not allowed to go and disclose this relation and this contact. No one is allowed to claim that he visited Imam Ali Salam in public.
Yes.
But what do we mean that we are trying our best to visit Imam Ali Salam and all these visitations of Imam Ali Salam true that, for example, some scholars claim that they visited Imam Ali Salam? I want to tell you, in the course of history, among the Shia scholars and even the companions of the Ahlul Bayt, we don't have anyone that has claimed something in his lifetime that he visited Imam Ali Salam.
Yes.
They just had an experience and they left it and they, for example, wrote it somewhere and it was disclosed right after their demise and death. So I want to say that this issue should not be claimed, should not be disclosed. And if anyone had the chance, he himself knows better, or she herself knows better what to do. And no one is waiting for her to say anything.
We get to some of the reasons why this must not be, we can say, announced publicly. Maybe there are some serious reasons for that. Let's take a break and then we'll continue our discussion. Brother Alavian, thank you very much. Dear listeners of Arab English Radio, Call of Islam Page, the program The Last Savior, we'll take a break and back in a minute.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. This thousand-year-old
Welcome back. Brother Alavian is in the studio to talk about the false claimants of visiting Imam Al-As. Okay, Brother Alavian, so not announcing publicly that you got a chance to visit Imam Al-As. Now let's talk about the whyness. I mean, why we are not allowed?
It might have lots of consequences, brother. One of these consequences that would be like something, I mean, a benefit for the person who claims such a thing. Uh-huh. When you claim that, for example, you had an extraordinary power to meet the one who is the essence of creation, and I mean, everyone is deprived of his visiting that, I mean, usual. So actually, it's sort of, I don't know, market is going to open for you, I mean, at your lifetime. While it is not true, because Imam is usually giving the chance to those who are selfless people, not those who are in the favor of gaining something through this visitation.
Or, for example, somebody to be proud that, okay, I have visited Imam Al-As, I've got this, I've done that.
Visitations usually happen just to solve a problem from the Islamic Ummah. That deep lover definitely knows what to do and what not to say and what to say right after his visit. Through the conduct and behavior of a person, some people might guess, for example, that this person had the chance to, for example, visit Imam alayhi salam. But none of those who had this chance to visit Imam alayhi salam claimed openly and outspokenly that they had this chance. They definitely know about the consequences or bad consequences of such claims. We need to know that those who claim that they had a contact with Imam alayhi salam, or at least openly claim such a thing, we should get to this assurance that they don't have any sort of contact with Imam alayhi salam. This is at least something that we can take it very clearly that, okay, this person at least had no chance to visit Imam Ali. Because anyone who visited, like those who have been given a mystery, their mouth are definitely...
sealed.
Are sealed with
That's right.
those valuable things that they have received. Having a role model with these characteristics, that with this beautiful moral and spiritual characteristics is a really great chance for us to have. When you are trying to approach yourself, to close yourself to that beautiful entity, then some of your actions definitely change.
Yes.
I mean, your behavior, your treatment with others would change definitely because you are trying to tune yourself to be able to meet that great entity.
Yes.
Then what would be the outcome? The outcome is that there are some good changes in your own personal behaviors. So we have to know that having a role model usually, even in psychological discussions, is being recommended. And so we have this beautiful role model that we definitely, the followers of the School of Ahlul Bayt, we know what a beautiful role model we have selected for ourselves.
Okay.
So having this role model is really giving us energy towards goodness.
That's right.
What better ma'ruf, amr bil ma'ruf, than this relation, that is, this goodness better than this beautiful and holy existence.
Okay, that's right. Let's take our second break and then we'll continue our discussion. Brother Alavian is with us in the studio of Call of Islam Radio, Arab English Radio.
أهدى سنه مهديون في الأزمان شع ضيه ربنا في العالمين أضفع له نور أليق والظالم ابتده من أجل السالك أهدى سنه
Welcome back dear listeners of Arab English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am Atta, the host of this program. Okay, Brother Alavian. So, consider a case that a person claims he visited Imam al-Asr.
Yeah.
And we know that person as a very righteous one. Are there any criterion put by Imam al-Asr or in our hadith collection or Quranic ayahs to distinguish such people, I mean the wrong claimants of visiting from the right ones or not?
Look, as we said earlier, a person who had this chance to visit Imam Ali Salam, his mouth is usually sealed.
Okay.
So there is no chance for anyone to claim whether he is a righteous person or not righteous person.
Okay.
So anyone who claims he is condemned to the false claim.
Okay.
So we don't have anyone who claims that, okay, I had this relation, even if he had reached the highest levels of taqwa. We definitely say that he has lost this level of taqwa or piety. So there's no excuse for anyone to claim that he had a sort of relation or, I don't know, visitation of the Imam alayhi salam.
As you said, this gate might not be open into the society because visiting Imam al-As would lose its true color, isn't it?
Definitely.
Because it loses its true authenticity among the people. Then every day, such and such person all around the world, not only Islam, but out of the borders of Islam, may claim that, okay, today I visited Imam al-As, he told me to do this, not to do that.
And we had it. I mean, lots of people had claimed that they are the savior, the promised savior, inside Islam and outside Islam, in Christianity or even in Islam.
Yes.
From different parts of the world, then they claim that they are that awaited savior that the whole humanity is waiting for. So to have such claims, I mean, it would actually harm the discussion itself. I mean, the topic of Mahdawiyya. There is one important point that we need to, I think, mention it here, brother. As we said, that having a very beautiful and comprehensive and, let's say, perfect role model is very important.
Yes.
And it correct ourselves first. I mean, it is for our benefit first rather than for the benefit of the other side, that is the Imam alayhi salam. But we know that in the prayers of pilgrimage of any imam, we recite this famous sentence that I witness that you are listening to me.
Yes.
And you are watching me and you are listening to my words.
Yes.
And you are seeing even my status. So, أَشْهَدُ أَنَّكَ تَسْمَعُ كَلَامِي وَتَرُدُّ سَلَامِي. That is, even you reply back my salams. So, when we have this knowledge for our imams, Then what are all these efforts for? Just to have this? Definitely it is a great honor.
Yes.
Definitely there is nothing sweeter than this. But why should we, I mean, get involved in such discussions and in such issues just to have this